Michael?
Yeah.
All right, so thanks for coming, and I've tried to put together sort of an impromptu, maybe not challenge, but at least sort of series of examples to complement what Daniel was talking about and what others, including Pankaj and Ned and David, were talking about. And so I want to just disclaim from the start that I'm not going to be dealing with the same exact problems. This is not a talk about how many different types, whether you call them genotypes or strains or species, do you maintain in a given set of conditions. Let me just motivate this a little bit, but with a simple observation that natural communities are often highly diverse. That's sort of a truism. It doesn't matter what you look at. It could be grasses and shrubs and trees in a, you know, in a landscape. This is from the Okanagan in British Columbia, which is the little bit of California that pokes up into Canada and everybody gets excited about because it's Canada's highest diversity area because it's this little lip that comes up. But anyway, it's a special place to me.
It also has wine.
It has good wine. yeah, decent wine, especially for Canada. And these are different morphotypes of Pseudomonas aeruginosa that evolved over about 50 generations in an experiment that we did in the lab. It doesn't matter what you talk about. And one of the challenges I tried to make during Daniel's talk, but I didn't want to derail it too much, is that there are people who've been studying how diversity measured in a variety of different ways scales with biological organization. And that the central theme, I think, that comes out of that, if I could broadly describe it, would be that it doesn't matter what you look at. It could be variation within a population, populations among, within a species, species within communities, and so on and so forth, until you get to the highest taxonomic levels. But anyway, so what I...
And these morphotypes are genetically different?
These are all genetically different. Yeah. I'm going to talk about flavors of that. But so community ecology for decades, if not a century, has been, you know, getting their knickers in a twist over how many different species can coexist. I think there's another interesting, I would argue, less well-studied and maybe more challenging question is how does that diversity evolve in the first place? And that's sort of where a lot of the work in my group has been focused. So,
what if I had a two-hour talk? That's what I would have started.
Right. So consider this. I won't even pretend to give the second half of your talk, but let's call this the empirical version or the experimental version. So this is a cartoon of how I think you can capture a few decades of work in thinking about the evolution of diversity from an evolutionary ecology perspective. So I owe a huge debt to people like Dolph Schluter, who've really sort of been pushing this field ahead. This is the idea. So you have some measure of fitness or phenotype along this axis, and this is some measure of the environment. And the only point here is that, you know, things can specialize under, there might be different phenotypic optima across this environmental gradient of some form. That's what ecologists would call, or evolutionary ecologists call, ecological opportunity, vacant niche space, however you define that. I'm not going to get into the specifics about it because it's all qualitative, it's not quantitative. But there are different ways in which you can make a living. You could specialize in different resources or so on and live in different environments and so on. That generates divergent natural selection towards these different optima. And that eventually leads, in the long run, to niche specialization and presumably to speciation. It might be this bit here, where labeled ecological interactions, is in braces, because the standard thinking in evolutionary ecology is that ecological interactions like resource competition, or predation, or mutualism, or parasitism, or whatever it is, can accelerate and exaggerate divergent natural selection by basically getting rid of the hybrids and creating disruptive selection. So you get more strongly divergent types at a faster rate. And that's, but at least the same endpoint. So that's kind of the cartoon version of what we call the ecological theory of diversification.
So I try to understand it. So the horizontal axis for space, this would be an example of sympatric speciation?
Yeah, it could be, it doesn't have to be. It could be allopatric. There could be dispersal among these things. Really, I'm trying to just get a cartoon sort of framework for thinking about this, because that's pretty much as far as the theory has gone. You can criticize this in any number of ways. you know, so many different things are, that we don't understand. But arguably, this is a fairly well-accepted version. The biggest gap, in my personal view, is that there's no genetics in it.
Even, never mind the genetics, I mean, a lot of it is words. And then there were sort of some kind of equations people write down.
Yeah, yeah.
But how specialized or how sort of general, I mean, I haven't, you know, tried to learn this, but it somehow, it's well pushed and so on, but you feel,
so is the
even
data
without
there?
The genetic, even at phenotypic right. level.
Okay, so.
Sort of as far as theory
so I think to some extent, yes. And if you want to read all about it, is the shameless bit of self-promotion.
Oh.
you can look into my book, which was published in 2014, so it's gravely out of date at the moment. But I review, for example, what we've learned about the evolution of niche specialization from microbial experiments, and apologies to all the Drosophila people. I didn't really pay attention to this, but all the microbial experiments. So, trade-offs, how trade-offs evolve, the role of mutation accumulation versus antagonistic pleiotropy, the notion of a cost of adaptation, the geometry of adaptation, and so on. You know, what we knew.
So it's experiment.
It's a monograph. It's
yes,
a, yeah. I've just reviewed the field of experimental evolution.
And theory and so on.
Yeah. And I initially wrote it, in case you're interested, both to be the book that I hoped that I would have when I started as a graduate student and didn't have, and also to convince my more ecological colleagues to pay attention to microbial experimental evolution. What I've learned since it's been published is that the first goal was achieved. I get students come up to me all the time saying, thank you for this. The second goal, not at all. Nobody pays attention to it, including all my colleagues. Anyway.
I hope that's a generational thing.
That's my hope. That's my hope. Okay.
Hopefully in your lifetime.
Yeah, hopefully. Anyway, so these are the three things I want to tell you about. If we get to them, I'll talk about, in the first instance, about the emergence and fate of diversity under divergent selection. Then I'll, especially for Alan, who's been asking me, I want to talk about some of the recent work that we've been doing. This is unpublished stuff on the drivers of ecological of diversification in the CF lung, the cystic fibrosis lung, and in the end, some older work, if we get to it, on the role of resource competition in the genomics of niche specialization. So here's the first study. Basically, the motivation for this study was actually in the spirit of what Paul Turner mentioned a couple weeks ago, of trying to integrate applied-facing problems with evolution. We confront that evolutionary biology with those applied-facing problems. We're going to think about drug sanctuaries as a means of controlling or at least managing the rate at which drug resistance spreads. This is an old idea from the agricultural literature that's used to quite good effect in terms of managing insecticide resistance, but it doesn't work. They don't use it very much, at least consciously, in clinical settings. I'm going to work with Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is a common opportunistic pathogen. I'll say more about that in the next section. For the moment, it's just a bug. Gram-negative pod, large genome, 6.5 or 7 megabase pairs. Propagated for about 250 generations in a rich medium, standard LB, in supplemented daily transfer with sub-inhibitory concentrations of ciprofloxacin, which is a fluoroquinolone antibiotic. Okay, fluoroquinolones are often used to treat urinary tract infections and also with CF patients. So that represents these blue, every day, every block here is a day, so daily supplementation. We'll have a permissive condition where there's no supplementation, it's just the same, the growth medium. Look at the effect of temporal variation in drug sanctuaries, first a day with drug, then a day without, and so on and so forth. And then a spatially variable one where we have one patch that contains the drug and one patch that doesn't, and every day we're going to just remove individuals, mix them together, and redisperse them. And the idea here is this is a crude model, very, very crude simulacrum of what might happen, for example, in a hospital, where you have wards that might, one ward might give the drug, another might not, but there'll be a mixture of doctors, nurses, attendants, patients among wards, okay? It is, each treatment is replicated 12 times, initially in isogenic lineage, just as Rich and everybody always does. And we're going to monitor the MIC, the minimum inhibitory concentration, over time, as well as fitness for isolates removed from these each replicate population.
Right, so fitness is going to be
fitness
in
is going
the
to be
condition
in the absence of a drug.
Okay.
Yeah. Competitive, usually competitive, sometimes
against competitive against the wild.
Yeah, or growth rates. We might, but anyway, the interesting. This is the sort of most really to me interesting stuff. Okay, this is log MIC. The blue line here represents the MIC of the ancestor that started the experiment. Each column represents a replicate population, and these are eight individual isolates from each population that have been, their MIC has been measured independently. So under permissive conditions where there's no, where they never experience a drug, typically they don't evolve resistance. That's not surprising. I mean, there's a little bit maybe, but it's not really. When you supplement daily, you get a constant daily supplementation, you get a large increase in resistance. Not surprising. This is temporal variation. And again, you get a large increase in the level of resistance, which is basically identical to what we see under constant saliva.
So what is the level that they're evolved in on the scale? That's the original MIC, is that?
Yeah, that's the answer.
You're answers. Evolving them in sub MIC, so where is the, what's the level you're
evolving? We've given them enough drug, I can't remember the exact concentration, but to knock down the population to about, by 80%. Knock down the ancestral population.
So they're still growing.
They're still growing, but at a very low rate.
Okay.
And this is just what...
So it's close to MIC or something like that.
Yeah, but it's not quite there. And this is just what happens to evolve along the way. So this is the temporal treatment, really identical, basically identical to what happens under the constant supplementation. But in the spatially variable environment, again, where you have these, you know, one patch with and one patch without and dispersal, you get a range of outcomes. Sometimes they seem to be almost entirely resistant, but in a few instances, and quite a number, you get coexistence between sensitive and resistant types. Okay, so I'm going to focus in on that a little bit more.
So the different points are different clones from the same replicate?
Yes, yeah.
And are these phenotypic variations
that you're seeing,
and are those also reflected in mutations or not?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, we have now received the genome sequences back. We haven't processed them yet. We know this is genetic because if you subculture them, they maintain it. So, classic microbiology, right? But this is agenomic at the moment. So this is just the dynamics in those each replicate population of that spatial treatment of the frequency of resistance over time, over about 40 days of the experiment. So these are all just replicates from independently evolved replicates. And the only point here is there's lots of fluctuations. You get what seems to, in some instances, a dampened fluctuations that lead to coexistence. Other instances, you actually get fixation of the resistant types. May even occasionally get the loss of resistant types, but it seems to be less frequent.
So this is in which conditions? This is in
the spatial.
Spatial. Okay.
Yeah.
And so you switch everybody, or just you're sampling?
We're just sampling a small fraction from the population, mixing that, and then returning them at random. So it's a random.
And what fraction?
Well, it's 1 to 100. The dilution is 1 to 100. So they grow up. So we're taking a very small volume.
And then you put them into the media.
Yeah. Okay. So that's just the dynamics, and I think I'll come back to this a little bit. So why do they coexist? They coexist because there's a trade-off between being resistant and how well you grow in the absence of drug. And I want you to ignore the different colors for the moment. So this is the level of resistance down here. Highly resistant types, this is growth rate in the absence of drug relative to the ancestor, which is this dashed line. Okay. So highly resistant types tend to have a cost of resistance on average, and less resistant types grow better. Okay, that's the classic trade-off. But interestingly, this diversity is also maintained by negative frequency dependent selection. So before I get to this, this is just the data. Again, ignore the different colors for the moment. This is the starting frequency of the resistant type. And its fitness in a head-to-head competition against a sensitive type. So rare resistance have high fitness, and common ones have low fitness. And that's exactly what's predicted by an old model in population genetics by Howard Levine, which is pretty similar to how we did the experiment. We didn't set out to test this model initially, but it turns out, so you imagine you have a mixed population of genotypes at the beginning. They get distributed into two patches, a square and a circle patch. Square individuals do best in the square patch, circle ones do best in the circle patch, so there's selection within each patch. Some number of individuals come out. At the end, they get mixed and the cycle gets repeated. And Levine showed, specifically under in a diploid system with recombination, that you can maintain.
Are there any social effects here? I mean, can non-resistant bacteria profit from the...
Not that we know of. Resistance to ciprofloxacin is... in Pseudomonas is chromosomally, there are chromosomal SNPs. The targets of resistance are fairly well known. They typically are either efflux pumps, so you just pump out stuff, or topoisomerases, which maintain the supercoiling structure of DNA. And basically what happens is you get a change in the binding pocket of the isomerase that prevents the drug from binding to DNA and introducing double-stranded breaks. That's how the...
I mean, the pumps presumably make it worse for the others.
We have lots of data from another experiment, which I won't tell you about the genomics and the genetic effects of these different resistance mutations.
Here, the computation assay is done in a mixed environment?
Yeah, or? It's done. So this is all done in the same set of conditions of spatially separated selection. And so we send them through a couple of rounds of this and measure initial and final frequencies. So the prediction from the model was that always been, and this has sort of informed a lot of population genetics as well as community ecology, that you've got stable coexistence and a protected polymorphism that can't be lost. Okay. This is just another sort of our way of, without genomics, of assaying clonal interference for clonal interference. So those fluctuations that we saw are hard to explain if what you're getting is stable coexistence. Fluctuations in these frequency dynamics are hard to explain if this is actually a stable coexistence. They should just even out and you should just maintain.
But it's not that there's no other selection going on. There's some other selection going on, you'll hitchhike up and down things and get fluctuations.
And so this is just a way of saying, look, there's lots of stuff going on in there. This is the sort of the same invasion from rare kind of experiment where we take a pair of resistance and sensitives and just introduce them into the population at different starting frequencies and track their frequency over time. And initially, after a few days, they all converge to some equilibrium level and then they start to diverge again, presumably because they're accumulating lots of mutations. So, but it's not due to the stochasticity that we introduced during transfer or anything like that. So now we can pay attention to the colors. What I've done here is color these assays, these points, by where in the experiment the individuals were isolated. The orange ones are from day 20 in the experiment, and the purple ones from day 40, as you can see, I've labeled it that way. This is the trade-off. At day 20, there's a nice intermediate frequency here where it crosses the one line. And you can see that these resistant genotypes out here have actually started to compensate for their, you know, they're still resistant, but they're getting better at growing in the absence of drug. And that leads to a change in the predicted equilibrium under this negative frequency dependent selection that goes from about 0.6 at day 20 to about 0.8 by the end of the experiment. So basically what's happening is that these resistant genotypes are accumulating compensatory mutations that are changing the trade-off and leading to the eventual loss of diversity in this experiment. So we have the emergence of diversity through divergent selection. It's quasi-stable coexistence through negative frequency-dependent selection, but its eventual demise through continued selection.
What's the origin of the negative frequency-dependent selection?
It has to do with strong divergent selection coupled with a dispersal.
So the logic of why that works.
So in the original model, Levine's original model, there was a subtle thing that was picked up on a couple of years later, which is that you have to have population regulation occurring at the level of each patch. So what that means then is that a rare genotype that's specialized to a particular patch is guaranteed to make it through to the next.
You have soft selection on the
two. Exactly, you have soft selection.
Right. Yeah.
neither one could survive another one's patch.
Yeah. So that's the origin of negative frequency. And we're actually running a second experiment now, which is designed to test that specifically, but I don't have the data. So I guess the reason why I wanted to show this in the context of everything, we've had a number of talks already about let's assume we've got a large number of species, and so it is possible to actually study this process emerging in a relatively short-term experiment.
I guess one of the questions is, in this context and just in general, is there any such thing as a constant environment? And so when you look at diversity within environments or between environments, and it does seem that, you've written a book literally on this, you start with an environment and there's no such thing as an environment that's stable over time.
Well, I think, I agree. I mean, I think for reasons that many of which we've already discussed over the last few weeks, whether it's cross-feeding polymorphisms of different kinds or the formation of biofilms or...
I guess I count that as a constant environment. If the change of the environment is to do with the evolution of the other organisms...
That's still a constant environment, yeah.
Yeah, it's saying that you're getting the diversity in ecology. It's coming even though your external conditions.
Yes.
So it's definitely what environment means.
Yeah. It's a hard one. Yeah.
But the physical external environment.
In the ocean, you could have low light, high light in the ocean that would be fairly stable otherwise. I mean, you could always find that in the very.
Well, so this is where I think there's a real opportunity for the quantitative, call it the physics way of thinking, to come together with the actual biology, because every ecologist will look at anything that the physicists have presented and go, yeah, but there's just got to be a lot of niches out in the real world. And this isn't interesting. But the question is...
I'm talking to Penny Chisholm about the Diplodocus. They say that at this level, and I say, yeah, but what about this level? And at some point it starts getting into storytelling if it's at a final level.
I agree. But the other thing that I think... So in my book, there's not a lot of data out there, but I've got an example at the end of the... put at the end of the talk in case anybody's interested, but this question about to what extent do in genotypes or populations create niches for other genotypes, right? So in other words, in what sense does the environment itself evolve? The message from the few examples we have in microbial experimental evolution is not a hell of a lot. So most of the time, not a hell of a lot. So there's this idea that diversity begets diversity. It's a kind of a catchy phrase for paleontologists really like this when they think about broad-scale taxonomic diversification and so on. But the truth is, and this is also comes under the idea of niche creation or niche construction, Odling Smee and company, Kevin Leyland and so on. The truth is, and you can think of, I'm a Canadian, so I think of beavers, right? Beavers dam streams and they create habitats for other things. But at least in the microbial experimental evolution, I mean, what you'd predict is a steadily increasing rate of diversification over time in any of these experiments. You never see that. Always maxes out like a logistic.
But this is diversification at genetic level or phenotypes that you can observe?
Either. I mean, we don't have a lot of good data yet. Yeah. The best data probably actually, sorry to blow toot my own horn, probably comes from work that my former student Justin Meyer did with Paul Rainey's adaptive radiation, where we looked at how diversification in that adaptive radiation changes over a long period of time. Usually we just use that adaptive radiation to study how things happen at the beginning. But if you keep it going, what you see is a rapid increase, sort of exponential-like increase, a peak at about, in this case, after 4 days, and then you start to decline again. But you maintain some level of diversity, but you don't get more and more and more and more diversity.
Not even genetically.
Well, we don't know. So it might be that there's a lot that we're missing. And that's another truism, there's another lesson that comes out of studying this stuff, is that most of the diversity that we know about in these experiments is because we can see it on a plate.
Right, a small number of things.
Everybody and their dog studies small colony variants in bacteriology because they look different, right? But there might be a lot more, and I think we're just at the beginning of being able to understand that.
We don't have a particularly large number of trophic levels. Getting to defend the paleontologists
but
you have a lot of chemicals that are interacting.
Yeah, but we've
yeah, but
so
do you have the evolution of predation, for instance?
Yeah, so we've seen, so we've done experiments again with Paul's radiation with predators, and Angus Buckling's done them with phage. And
that
it's
age, I guess.
Yeah, it's still asymptotes. In fact, the main effect of predators in our hands is simply to slow the rate of diversification, because what they're doing is depressing prey densities and reducing the strength of resource competition. So,
what would one expect knowing nothing, right? So knowing nothing, I would say what you would expect is the sort of main things that you can make stories about, the niches and what they're doing, would you would diversify into that first, and then there were all the subtle differences that you would start, you know, diversifying in those. Now, whether that continues going or whether that's also limited, you know, I have no idea. But I guess the same thing you're saying is that the main phenotypically clear things, you know, go and then maybe saturate because you start getting, you know, somewhat general lists for those or something. That's the beginning of the question. But
absolutely.
I think the problem with the genetic ones is, of course, that you get a lot of genetic diversity just from the transient dynamics with no ecological interaction.
Well, and I think Mike's work with Rich's lines is a good example of that.
Right.
But I think that, I mean, I, from what I remember seeing last year when you presented it in Washington, was but there was clearly, I mean, you just could stare at those graphs and say, there's a lot of ecology going on in there.
Right.
It may not be terribly important in terms of it, as Rich says, for explaining the total variation in mean fitness over the experiment, but there's still a lot of ecology. And it seems as though, so I'm going to sit comfortably on the fence. I'm going to say, on the one hand, the data that we have so far in these shorter-term experiments says diversity does not beget diversity terribly much. On the other hand, I think there's a lot that we're probably missing still, and if we look hard enough, we might find it.
Yeah, cool, because the interesting diversity does not beget more interesting diversity, but could beget boring diversity.
Or it could get eventually interesting diversity.
Yeah, which eventually might be.
Which is like the SID plus story, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't need to sort of...
So just one more quick comment that I think is related to the broader themes that will emerge over the next couple of days and that were already introduced by Tony today is the difference between then sexual and,
right.
and asexual. And so one of the environments, depending on what we count environment, is the genomic background. And so whether or not that's fundamentally different in the way that these experiments then create diversity,
agreed.
Whether or not that can even occur. And the problem is that we can't carry out the experiments long enough because of
limitations.
Or
you can, or
you just have to...
You say it's not important, which is kind of what...
But I think that's not clear because then when you start having... different alleles that are specializing in the way that your microbes are they able to coexist against the different genetic
backgrounds? I agree. I entirely agree.
Stuff. So I think that's an interesting question.
I entirely agree. And none of this stuff is sexual. Anyway, so let me just switch and quickly tell you this other story that we're working on right now, which is, again, this is part of this sort of general effort to confront evolutionary biology and more applied problems about infections of the cystic fibrosis lung. So just quick background on what CF is. It's a genetic disorder caused by mutations in the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator, or CFTR gene. So homozygous recessives for, there's about, I think, 100 different alleles that can cause the disease, but there's one or two that are really prevalent in most Caucasian populations. Has a manifold range of impacts, but basically what it does is it impacts chloride ion transport. The most important for the context of this experiment and probably for the health and well-being of adult CF patients is that one of the downstream impacts of this mutation is that it reduces the ability of individuals to clear fluid from their lungs. Okay? For a variety of reasons that are not entirely well understood mechanistically, but basically if you talk to a CF patient, they will say, having CF is like drowning from the inside. It's a pretty graphic and powerful statement. This is sort of what happens in a normal lung, in a normal airway. We get an infection or something, you know, we tend to get a lot of mucus. It might be uncomfortable for a couple of days, but we can usually cough it out, spit it out, or whatever it is. And the cilia on the inside of the lumen of the lung are capable of working well and helping us clear the mucus and so clear the infection. Individuals with CF can't do that. So they basically have this very, very highly blocked airways. It's very difficult for them to clear their lungs at all, and then so they're very prone to infection.
as big as the cilia or less agile?
They are. They're actually basically reduced. They're
shorter.
Yeah. There's other things that go on. But what's sort of an interesting phenomenon with this disease is that treatments for dealing with this is only one way in which the disease manifests. 40 years ago, individuals with CF they typically died before reaching teenagehood. And they died of other reasons, of nutritional problems associated with organ failure and so on. But those sorts of things we've dealt with them. And now the locus of disease is really focused on the airways. At the same time, people are living longer, and so they become more prone to infection. So it's really the infections that the community of CF people are dealing with right now. In Canada, and this is also true in the UK and in the States, around 70% of adult CF patients are chronically infected with Pseudomonas aeruginosa. There's lots of other bugs there as well. Some of them are really bad, Burkholderia and so on and so forth, occasionally aspergillosis and so on. But Pseudomonas has been really the one that's been difficult to deal with because it's recalcitrant to infection or to treatment. The only way you can deal with, once the infection becomes chronic, the only way you get better is through a lung transplant. I like to show this, it's a very striking image. That's Ava Markvoort. I think I talked about it in my talk a few days ago. She died at the age of 25. She was from Vancouver, where I grew up, from complications associated with basically pneumonia from Pseudomonas or from chronic infection with pneumonia. She had a lung transplant. It didn't take. She blogged about her life with the disease. It's very, you can go see the blog. You can listen to her goodbye message. It's very powerful. I actually talked to her mother. A couple years ago, but anyway.
Those are little.
Oh, don't worry about it. It's just an image to fill the space, really. anyway, so that's CF and chronic infection with PA. But what you need to remember is that it is the leading cause of morbidity and mortality in this patient population. There's been a lot of work over the last 10 years or so on the genomics associated with these infections, a number of longitudinal studies, a few cross-sectional studies, including some of our own. I'm just going to summarize that work right now. Basically, the story of Pseudomonas aeruginosa is an opportunistic pathogen. It's everywhere, right? So if you go into the washroom here, you're likely to find it. You could probably wipe it, pick it off of the table. If you're healthy, you typically don't worry about it. But when you're immunocompromised, like CF patients are, then you do have to worry about it.
Why are they immunocompromised?
Partly because it's not clear, but this seems to be a knock-on effect of the disease. Their immune systems go sort of into hyperdrive. And so they're not compromised in terms of they can't detect it, like an HIV, like an HIV where the HIV the infection is actually destroying the immune system. But what happens is they get some infection, immune system kicks in and actually starts to create more damage itself to the lung tissues.
It's of inflammation and damage to the lung is driven by the inflammation.
Yeah, exactly.
But cytokine storm.
Yeah, exactly. What's happening, so the model of infection that we've sort of we've got is that we've got a globally circulating and highly recombining population of Pseudomonas that from time to time gets into one of these individuals and stays there. Okay, and it stays there throughout the life of that patient and it replicates well and it accumulates SNPs and so on and other kinds of mutations, and that's what causes the damage. So those sorts of adaptations, the pathoadaptations in the patient, seem to be associated with the loss of virulence factors, so they basically are going into stealth mode to escape the immune system in some way. Antibiotic resistance, because that's how they get treated, and they lose motility and tend to form biofilms or unattached microcolonies.
The motility normally is like just twitching motility?
Twitching and swimming. They have flagella. The other thing that happens, which we haven't really got a good handle on yet, is that there's rapid in situ phenotypic and genomic and genetic diversification within the lung itself, within the different compartments of the lung. And this is important because one of the ways, knowing that you've got chronic infection with Pseudomonas is really important for managing the patient's health. And people have been looking and looking and looking for biomarkers or phenotypes that could tell you that you've got that chronic infection. The problem is, the bugs are so diverse within and among patients that it's almost impossible.
Sorry, I have a question I asked that month after you left. So if you look at the bug, these bugs in a given person and those that are genetically identical, is it clear they're going to be phenotypically identical? Is that known?
Sorry, if you look at it like an environmental strain?
You go into some of these labs, you look at it, and you see some genetic diversity because, as you say, they evolve.
Yeah.
But then you only look at those that are genetically identical. Is it clear that they're going to be phenotypically identical?
No, there's lots of shit going on here. Excuse my language, but it's just, we really don't understand. The point is that part of the reason we don't understand it is there's so much diversity. And so we have this other project, I won't talk about it, but we're...
And so another question, once somebody gets infected with this and they evolve a resistant phenotype, can they infect other people?
Yes. So in the old days, being the old days, a little bit longer. In the 90s, I remember when I was an undergraduate, I worked for a hands-on science museum in Vancouver, and we were sent around the province to do, you know, bed of nails and all these sorts of things. That's where I learned all my physics. One of our stops was a CF camp, right, for kids. So we used to bring everybody together to help them learn and socialize with each other about living with this disease. Of course, they were also sharing infections. So, in practice now, they don't do that anymore. So in practice, most patients, when they get infected, there are some strains that seem to be highly transmissible, but the majority of patients sort of harbor their own private strain, and as long as they don't, you know, meet another patient.
So most people who get infected are infected with
a private strain.
And then initially with a non-resistant.
I wouldn't say non-resistant, because Pseudomonas is highly resistant to begin with, but they become more resistant.
And this disturbing picture is actually growing on a natural seed of blood?
No, this is on blood agar or something like
blood.
That.
Blood agar?
Yeah.
I presume if they cough, they can kind of put it into the air in an area? So
they could, yes. But, I mean, they're probably not terribly good at surviving the environment anymore because they lose motility, for example, and a bunch of other things. But,
And so do we know whether most of the evolution happens within a host or if it's a little...
It's within a host. From what we can tell so far, it's predominantly within
are
a host.
Are they evolving in the host or in the presence of phage that are trying to attack the bacteria?
That's not clear. We have very little idea of how much phage. There probably is quite a bit, but I don't think there's... I don't think there's good data on that yet.
The phage therapy has been tried?
Well, this is what we were talking about. Yeah, I don't know if they've been tried yet.
What's the reduction of mutators among those?
Mutators can be quite high, but it's highly variable. So on average, there was a Francois Tadet, in fact, I think, did a study back in the late 90s, just surveying for mutators among CF isolates and so-called environmental isolates, and they were higher in CF lungs, but in our, from what we can tell, that there's sometimes there, there's sometimes not. So, again, in the theme of diversification, I want to ask what we're interested in, part of what we're interested in is what drives that diversification. And one way of thinking about that is, again, to return to this sort of ecological theory that I, or cartoon that I showed earlier, and sort of say, well, what parts of the lung might or might not, or what part of the environment in which these bugs are experiencing might or might not fit that. There's certainly a lot of spatial structure associated with different airway compartments. You have this area, your paranasal area, is quite different from the deep lung. You have different lobes and so on and so forth. It's not at all clear. I'm sure that one of the questions is how much mixing is there? We have no idea. The best data we've got so far was I don't think it was this study, it was another one, that took about 10 resected lungs from patients that had undergone lung transplant and dissected, you know, and basically grew and then sequenced populations of Pseudomonas from different compartments, and there's lots of diversity. as much as we can say.
1979
is a year or a page? Oh, this is just, again, a cartoon. This was a study that looked at a longitudinal change in a single patient originally infected in 1979. But my point was just to show this as a, that there's lots of spatial variation in the lung.
But those ones that were done, was it, does it look as if it was one strain originally and then some diversification within the lung?
Yes. Typically, so this is not like a malaria. So Andrew Reed and company, and there's a lot of multiple infection with malaria and other kinds of human parasites and so on and so forth. That's not with Pseudomonas. It doesn't seem to be that. Largely, this is in situ.
HIV, right? And HIV.
Is that
correct?
Yeah, I think it would be similar to HIV.
And so, do people have similar data sets as they have for? Idea.
There's a handful of them. There's a Danish group that has one. There's a group in Toronto. I was working with a guy in Ottawa who, we don't do longitudinal, he doesn't have longitudinal data, but we've got a cross-sectional data set. So there are a handful. The CF community is a bit weird. They're kind of very protective. And
is there a mouse model?
No. No, there is no animal model for this.
So why can't you knock out the gene?
They've tried, but the infection is totally different. So you have to, I shouldn't say totally different, but it doesn't mirror what happens in. So there seems to be, there might be a pig model now.
Yeah.
Okay, back to this. So spatial structure is there. The lumen of the lung is filled with mucus and a lot of other amino acids and so on. It's a very rich environment, representing a lot of different resources and lots of ecological opportunity. And of course, the thick mucus itself can also act to reduce dispersal. And these are all conditions that ecologists would say is a great opportunity for diversification. And so what amongst other things that we're working on, but we've done is tried to design a sort of crude experimental test to disentangle the effects of spatial structure or the viscosity of the mucus from the nutrient complexity of the lung medium. And this is helped immensely by, you can't see it here, a group out of Texas, Marvin Whiteley's group, who had a number of CF patients spit into Falcon tubes and then mass spec'd the whole thing and created a defined CF-like, synthetic CF-like medium, lung medium. So basically, it's just some average of what's in the sputum of all these patients, and but we can assemble it in the lab. And so, basically, we're going to do a factorial experiment where we contrast the degree of nutrient complexity by propagating a single strain of Pseudomonas, which is originally from an acute infection, in the presence of synthetic cystic fibrosis medium, or in minimal medium supplemented with glucose. So we have basically, this is like Rich's experiment. And then we're going to do that by contrasting the degree of spatial structure by either adding mucin, which is basically snot, or not.
That would be made by goblin cells?
Yeah. This is pig mucin. This is what the cultures look like when we propagate them in a 24-well plate. This is in the presence of synthetic CF-like medium. You can see the characteristic greenish color of Pseudomonas there. And when you add the mucin, you get these little boogers, basically, collecting at the bottom.
Do they make cilia?
No. They lose cilia.
The black bits have the Pseudomonas in it also.
Yeah, they're just sort of microcolony collections. So what we did this in a highly replicated fashion, assayed multiple clones from each population. Not really the point of this slide, there's a lot of data here. These are a bunch of different clinical endpoints that people often look for: swim motility, twitch motility, biofilm formation, and then the different treatments. These different colors represent different replicates, and the different X's are isolates from within each treatment. You can see that biofilm formation, for example, is highest in synthetic cystic fibrosis medium with mucin. They lose motility, different kinds of motility, in the presence of mucin, largely. The only point of this slide is just to say we're roughly recapitulating the pathoadaptive types that we see in the lung in an in vitro system. So Alana Schick, who's the student who did this, spent a lot of time phenotyping the colonies that we get in the same way that a clinical microbiology lab might, by measuring things like degree of pigmentation or opacity and surface texture. It's sort of very qualitative, but what kind of typical for what you would do. And the four different treatments, these are the histograms of the different phenotypes, phenotype categories. So they tend to be slightly more, this is an average of 2+ or two plus or just below two different kinds of colony morphologies in the presence of nutritional complexity, but no effective spatial structure. We wanted to get deeper into this, and so we got a whole bunch of other phenotypes, including growth rate in standard LB, pyoviridin production, which is iron scavenging molecule, pyocyanins, biofilm formation, swim motility treatment, so on and so forth, antibiotic resistance. And then collapsed all this into basically a Euclidean distance of pairs of individuals from each other within populations. These are all different replicate populations from the cystic SCFM medium, from the minimal medium, SCFM plus mucin, and so on and so forth. The point here is the larger the value, the more diversity you have within a population. So lots of diversity in the presence of synthetic cystic fibrosis medium, in other words, nutritional complexity, somewhat less in the presence of when you add mucin. So nutritional complexity is...
I guess I don't understand this measure. So Euclidean distance in...
We have a whole bunch of different phenotypes. We want to ask how different are they within a population?
Right, so you're scaling the phenotypic
quantities
so that each...
So each one's a
scale.
Yeah.
And then you're looking at all the pairwise, or you're looking at the diameter. I mean, what property have you been looking at of the...
Should be something
like...
Only
Euclidean distance.
It's just an average Euclidean distance so you take an individual and you measure all these phenotypes. You take another individual from the same population,
right,
and you measure all those phenotypes. You just ask how far away are they from each other in that multivariate space.
Okay.
And that's this.
So why is that a diversity measure?
It's a divergence in phenotypic space.
A maximum divergence.
Yeah.
In other words, a typical divergence.
Yeah, typical average amongst all pairs of individuals. It's crude. And the reason we're doing this, a very explicit reason, I wouldn't normally do this as an evolutionary biologist, but it's crude because these are the kinds of things that people study, microbiologists and clinical microbiologists. So we want to, as a first step, capture whatever it is that they're looking for. The only point I think that's really, two points that are important. One is there's lots of variation in the amount of diversity. There's more variation, more phenotypic variation when you have this nutritionally complex medium compared to when you have a nutritionally simple medium. So that's really the only point. It's very simple.
But more diversity in the sense of a broader range of the phenotypes.
Phenotypes, yes.
Which is a different question. I mean, I could just have two phenotypes that are divert, two genotypes that are diverted by more because of the more complex medium.
But there's a systematic effect according to the conditions in which
it seems to me that this measure doesn't have anything directly to do with
this diversity. Has nothing to do with fitness necessarily.
No, it doesn't have anything to do with diversity either. It's got to do with how far apart the phenotypes get.
Well, which is a standard measure of diversity when all you have are phenotypes. I mean,
I want to know how many phenotypes.
You mean you could make a PCA or something like this to try to find if there's one single.
So I've got that. I've
the distribution is broad, but sort of.
Well, let's start looking at the number of phenotypes that are clearly distinguishable. I mean, that's the simplest one.
Well, that.
You go back to.
Then that's one. This. This is just if you take a petri dish and you plate out.
Right.
You're going to get colonies that look slightly different.
This is the number of different ones you can see.
Not by eye on an agar plate. And there's not a huge effect, but there is a significant one, that in nutritionally complex media, you get more diversity, more colony morphology diversity than you do in nutritionally simpler media.
But then the next slide, you had different measures. It wasn't just...
Yes. Because the measures that we're getting here are not ones that you can get by looking at something.
Right. So if you look at these and you ask how many phenotypes
are there
now, the total number of phenotypes.
But we can't ask qualitatively or how many different phenotypes. We can only ask in some continuous space what is the variation.
No, because you each type.
Yeah, but they don't fall into clear categories. I mean, a growth rate.
I don't want them in categories. I just want to know are they if they're distinguishable from each other outside of statistical errors.
Ask whether the distribution looks
okay,
like
so I've got.
I don't want a distribution. Let's do the simplest thing. How many distinguishable phenotypic ones are there under with all these measurements?
Maybe this helps. Here's the PCA plot. So it's mess, but you can distinguish things. Here's the magenta here are in the SCFM, the nutritionally complex media. The mauve up here are the minimal media, okay? This is what happens when you have mucin in the mix with nutritionally complex media. And these are clinical isolates, actually, which are separate from the experiment that we had in the lab, and that's how they fall out. So I don't know if this helps. I didn't find this very useful because it's a bit of a mess.
Yeah, but if you measure 10 times the same cone, would it be 1.8 here?
How much does that
you could add that?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've done all this in replicated. We've done all this. I mean, I don't have the number for you, but I mean, it is reproducible.
No, but then there's still a simple question, right? So how many reproducibly different phenotypes are there? Never mind clustering, never mind anything else.
I cannot answer that question.
You can. You have the data to be able to answer that question.
We could, yes. We could, and we will now do that.
Yeah.
But I can't.
No, okay.
I can't give you the answer right now.
Each of them have a different phenotype. Then you want to see if there's clusters of them or something like this.
So I think.
No. Are they distinguishable?
Are they distinguishable first? Okay. Are there different phenotypes first?
Well, they clearly are. I mean, in a variety of different ways.
And if there are many, then it's very diverse. But then you can. Right. Does it matter? Okay, that's a different question. But
so the other, I mean, we don't.
I could run them all through all biologic plates, you know.
Yeah.
It's a phenotype, but it's not.
I agree. The choice of phenotypes here is motivated by what's happened in clinical practice.
These are relevantly phenotypically.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is,
And we've also got the genomic data, which is being processed right now, so we'll be able to ask, you know, how
does this phenotypic characterization impact the clinical outcome?
We don't know. That's an outstanding question that we don't know. I'm talking to a woman at McGill who's got does a lot of immunology, and we can send her our strains and so. But the truth is that most microbiologists working in the clinic or respirologists dealing with these patients are not, you know, they recognize that there's diversity there, but they really don't know what to do with it, and they don't know if they've never connected that to clinical outcomes.
Is there any pathology generated just by the infection itself?
In what sense?
They have
this inflammation. They have
long-term inflammation. But anything directly by the bacteria that's toxins?
No. That's weird.
But they're losing. That's part of what happens is that they lose all of that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's just occupying the niche and occupying the niche is triggering some damage.
Ecology is somehow.
Yeah. And just why Pseudomonas aeruginosa is better.
Why Pseudomonas and not Staph or something else is an outstanding question.
But also the Staph is easier to. Less difficult to clear.
Right. Haemophilus, I mean, I didn't include it, but there's some crude idea of sort of the successional dynamics so as a patient ages of what goes on. And the vast majority of patients end up with Pseudomonas. Not exclusively, but, you know, there are others.
But one of the issues, I think, is that it's not clear how representative what you would get in the sputum as far as measuring phenotypes of that is of what's actually there.
Yes.
Because the stuff that's coming out is the stuff
that's in here, so.
I don't think anybody really knows. I mean, the preferred way is bronchial lavage, but it's highly invasive and highly, you know, that's. Anyway, the only other thing I wanted to point out was that not only is there diversification, phenotypic diversification within these populations, you get it among the populations as well. So individual populations diverge quite substantially, and they diverge more in the presence of nutritionally complex medium from each other than they do in the absence of it. So it's just another way of saying there are many different phenotypic routes that are followed both within and among populations. And then, again, from a clinical standpoint, it's sort of reassuring as an experimentalist working in vitro, that we're, so we have a collection of 24 or so clinical isolates that we have characterized fairly well. We can characterize them for all the same phenotypes, and you know, we're not too far off. This is a sort of average distance from clinical isolates, from the collection of clinical isolates for our experimental treatments. And if you have SCFM or anything other than just minimal medium, you're fairly close to those clinical isolates. I mean, it's very qualitative, and I'm not going to.
The greens.
These are just there's two different classes of Pseudomonas isolates from CF patients. One is called the epidemic. These are these more transmissible strains, and the others are the non-epidemic, and that's just with and without. If you include those, or with or without. I don't want to make too much of that. We're still sorting it out. But it's more or less, you get the same story.
Are the patients treated with antibiotics? Even though it's easy to get resistance?
Yeah. Well, it's the only thing they can do.
Because also they're trying to treat the other bug there as well.
And typically what happens is actually, so what the sort of typical symptomology, if you like, is patients can live with chronic infection until they can't, and which basically means that every once in a while they get what's called an exacerbation. The population seems to explode in some way, and that's when they come in to the hospital. They get the treatment. Treatment with the antibiotics, even if you have resistant cells, resistance to most actually improves symptomology. So they feel better, but it doesn't eliminate the.
And then they get the irreversible damage if it's the lungs, right?
Yeah. The exacerbations are what you worry about, because that's where a lot of the damage comes in. Yeah. Okay. So that's sort of. I can go on if you want, but we don't have to. We can maybe, Daniel, you want to sort of take over with a few things. I guess my point in presenting a lot of this was just to say, look, we can start asking some of these ecological questions. With these experiments, they're short-term. They can be criticized for all the same reasons that everybody criticizes experimental evolution. But we can go further with a lot of these things. We can look at the genomics, which is what we're starting to do. We can look at how, you know, the genomic contributions to niche specialization and trade-offs and so on and so forth. So if you want, I can continue and tell you about resource competition, but I don't have to.
Can one barcode the Pseudomonas easily?
You probably could, yeah. There's no reason why not.
I mean, I don't know, but it's always, now it's getting easier to get minions, and the chromosome is always a bit tougher. Yeah. On plasmids, it's easy, but then the plasmids have their own life.
Yeah.
On the chromosome, it's always a bit difficult. But I mean, now it's with CRISPR tricks and everything.
What?
You want a barcode?
No, at least in lab ones. But,
you can inject the barcode in what?
To a pig. The pig is the yes.
Well, couldn't you take some of the bacteria out, barcode, and put it back in the same person?
I don't think you can do that.
These patients are not, the vast majority of these patients are not on death's door. And I think that's a really important thing to remember. They're not on death's door. So, you know, if you heard Paul Turner talking about his one successful phage experiment, phage therapy treatment, this is an individual where all of their options were gone, right? And so they gave him this guy phage therapy, and it worked. Most of the time, CF individuals live very normal lives.
And they used to go in and back and forth to doctors a lot.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, for trying out, you know, various things, their pool were... There's a lot of them, and there's a...
Well, they are receptive to treatments, but, you know.
I think based on what you're showing, once you take them out of the lungs, the evolution is going to be very different than in the lungs, right? I mean, you're basically showing a lot of...
I mean, yes, I don't think anybody... Well, we can now say that we've started to do some of that work, not with that intention, but we have other stuff where we've looked at, you know, different aspects of these questions, but
just going back to the question about the virulence of the strain, so you say that basically they lose all the virulence factors and so on, and that they keep triggering the inflammation, but are you sure that it's the whole population has lost it all, or is it just a fraction?
We don't really know.
There's one way to treat, there's some women and girls that have like constant urinary tract infection,
right.
And and so it's because of some malformation that it's extremely painful, and so they have it almost chronically. And one way to treat them is that they found in one little girl that she had some E. coli in her bladder that lost the ability to stick to the mammary, to the bladder, and then lives ever happily in the bladder without any symptom.
Yeah, it's amazing because it's so a very big number. It grows fast enough that it can avoid.
So it's basically being it's.
It doesn't
like
a niche.
Yeah, it's all
it's like a chemostat.
So now, and so now they're treating some. They have some. They're doing some trial where they try to find some people that have a chronic infection. They infect them. So they're always positive to E. coli infection, but the niche is occupied, so no nasty ones coming in. Yeah.
So when we pitch this stuff to granting agencies, right, we have some other work, comparative genomic work, suggests that redox-associated genes are really highly selected in the CF lung. Mm-hmm. And we said, working with this doc, this physician, he said, oh, well, just give them N-acetylcysteine, which is basically vitamin C, which we already give to patients to help them break up the mucus. But if you give it prophylactically to kids, it should reduce the redox, because it's a redox scavenger, basically. And so maybe you could prolong, you know, the time until chronic infection sets in. Now the criticism is always, yeah, but then you're, you know, something else will come in.
So this E. coli will not evolve to stick?
No, apparently they don't. There's no benefit. So they've done that. I don't know. They did that several years ago, and so they're on trials now.
I mean,
they
don't
eventually need to get lost, and so they reject it.
It's very specialized because it has to grow really fast, right, to avoid being diluted.
But don't forget also that
the urine is not that heavy in the nutrients.
In the CF lung,
someone will figure out how to stick and still evolve.
Right, eventually. Right. But there's some specific, you know, pili that are specialized in FMH.
In the CF lung, it's also, I mean, we focus on Pseudomonas because that seems to be the locus of the problem, but there's a whole community of bugs in there as well. So what causes the exacerbation, nobody really knows. And it doesn't seem even that when Pseudomonas exacerbates, it doesn't seem that it evolves a terrible amount. So it's not as if there's some rare mutant that sort of emerges and takes over. It doesn't, but at the same time, you know, Dave Gutman and others in Toronto have shown that you do get sort of clonal replacements over the life of patients of one strain with many different variants within that strain overtaking others. So there's
If you knock down Pseudomonas with antibiotics, do other bacteria grow and take over the niche?
Nobody's done the experiment. I mean, it doesn't.
I think the niche is still occupied enough.
Yeah, I think so. And of course, you don't want to
inside and so you don't clear all
this other issue of how severely should you. How, you know, I mean, lots of bugs, lots of drugs. It's pretty tough on the patients. So it's always.
That's what they do. I mean, even before they get to drugs, right?
Yeah, they're treating prophylactic.
Drugs and giving huge amounts of anti-inflammatories and so on, and it's not.
But going back to the global question about diversification, about your complex media versus simple media.
Yeah.
So what do you think is driving that?
I think it's just different ecological opportunities. I think that there's just a lot of different resources. We suspect that resource competition is playing a role, but we have no real.
You're sure a lot of the phenotype don't have much to do with the nutrients stuff.
We'll learn
after
we will learn more when we get the genomic data processed, because that'll give us some hints. It's hard to do the kinds of experiments that we would normally do in these simpler conditions of, you know, doing competitive fitness assays and so on and so forth. We can do them, but the strength of inference is less, partly because it's a pain in the ass to make synthetic CF media. that's a challenge.
So you order it or you do?
No, we make it ourselves. Yeah.
You make it, but it's a. I mean,
it's a defined medium.
It's
a
defined
recipe.
Medium. It's really a defined medium.
Yeah, but it's. But I mean, most defined media are, you know, take 10 grams of digested cow and put it in with 5 milliliters of glucose and mix and sterilize.
And then you get a disaster with evolution experiments and one version of King's Bee is
batch. Right.
Completely different. Yeah. I mean,
but that's why, so, you know, the other stuff we do has been on minimal media with, like, Rich's experiment, only with more resources, and that's, you know, this.
But one of the things is, I mean, also, you know, these bugs are metabolically complicated, right?
Yeah.
And so once you've got more resources, there's also many more other stuff in the medium. And one of the things we found, Ben Callahan found, that the in pseudomonas fluorescens, and in lab, very quickly, you developed a strain which could no longer grow in the medium that the ancestor made, basically. And they, but on a plate, they interacted in the opposite way. One was, you know, killing the other one and so on. And they were, you know, this wasn't research competition. It was something weird they're doing of some signaling things. What else? And they got these, and then you started to see that that evolved and what happened, you know, somewhat further. I mean, he didn't push it that much. And never got sequence of things. But the sort of, the especially when they're, you know, the basic saturation population, they're not growing exponentially all the time. I mean, they're there's an awful lot of things that they're interacting via other than resources.
I entirely agree.
Yeah.
I don't think, I mean, I think, I don't know quite what to say to that other than, you know, there's room for a lot of work here.
Yeah. You know? Well, no one will disagree.
You know, but I mean, you know, that's, I mean, we have very little, we don't even have really good ideas beyond some of the work that Guillaume Martin and Thomas Lenormand have done, extending Fisher's model to multiple optima, to start thinking about how niche specialization evolves in some general way, you know, and you could criticize Fisher's model from, you know.
But one needs to go to sort of high-dimensional things. I mean, that's the thing.
Well, clearly.
But the nice thing about some of the high-dimensional, there's some things that, you know, you can sort of say generally, and then you can ask if they, you know, relevant or not. But some, and it doesn't, it's not just like, you know, drawing two-dimensional peaks and three-dimensional peaks and so on. I mean, it's, you know, it's qualitatively different. I mean, it's not the
at some point, the two, so the, my comment, I think, the comment I would make to that is that, you know, ecology has been dominated by thinking about maintenance of diversity with under the assumption that you have lots of stuff to begin with. That's sort of the standard starting point of
lots of stuff,
lots of species or lots of genotypes.
Rather
than how do you get there. And evolutionary biology, to at least experimental evolution up until fairly recently, has been focused, and rightly so, on the simplest case, right? So now it's, you know, we can sort of come at it from both ends, I think, anyway, that would be, we can just, unless there's anything more pressing or really, I don't know what else to,
can I just, you know. I mean, you, Daniel, you suggested barcoding.
For the lab experiments.
Yeah, for the lab experiments, but would you, to do that more to learn about the species?
Well, one of the things, if you can do it, you can look at whether you get populations that are stabilized at some fraction, where for long times without having to phenotype them. You can then pull them out and phenotype them. Actually.
Well, the deep sequencing would accomplish the same thing, right? I mean,
if they have enough diversity, they're stable, and you can get human.
Well, I think when we look at
the deep sequence, you have to do individuals. It's harder because you
want. So sorry, how would that accomplish it? Because if you can have the same genotype but different phenotypes.
No, but that's. That you also get.
But
also, as soon as you, I think from von Cooper's thing and others, as soon as you go a biofilm from scratch, you get genotypic diversification that's sort of following the phenotypic one for different, you know, niches within the biofilm, and you get that very, very fast. So the phenotypic diversity, you're not, that you have to follow by measuring phenotypes in some way, but the genotypic diversity, you can track and ask, are there some stable genotypes there more than you would expect from transients? Now, of course, you have to understand the transients from the early evolution very well, but you can track that. Now, you really need systems like this one that, you know, Michael's group now has, being able to continue barcoding, so you don't lose all your barcodes early on, and that's all machinery that's magical machinery that you use.
You could add it afterwards, you could eventually, you know, evolve them at some point.
Right, and then you can add for a while.
And see whether at that stage you had already some, you know, frequency patterns.
So if you have good systems for putting a barcode with CRISPR or something that you can choose two sites, then you can put other sets later on at various points.
Talking about longer time scale than any of these experiments.
Well, which is...
No, they're holding them, see, this...
I mean, you could do...
This evolution is fast, right? The selective, one of the difficult Grzelinski's experiments is the selective pressures are pretty weak. Right here, this is strong, strong selection.
But we can also play, we can play with that as much as we want. I mean, I've toyed with the idea, this is a cartoon of another experiment we did with three different carbon sources. This is Rich's experiment, but it's 1,000 generations, and it's in mixed, where we mix all the carbon sources together, or we keep them separate with dispersal. I mean, how interesting would it be to keep that going for 60,000 generations? It would be very interesting.
But even if you keep in, like, the Calder-Finkel experiment, a star decoy is shaken, so it has no spatial structure, yeah. And it just has to keep, evolving to eat the remains of other E. coli. And it has, they just do it all by calling it, the whole experiment. And it has a lot of diversification in the ecology, and it continues and so on. And that obviously can't continue forever because it's gradually, losing biomass turnover.
Kept it going for you.
And it's rich medium to start with and so on. So whether one can do that
Look, I think personally, I mean, without knowing the details of the theory at all, I think there's some interesting potential for some theory where you building on the stuff that people in this room have done, thinking about what happens if you just add some, spatial complexity. We've heard that, a number of times, and let's be honest that it's one thing to say, oh, we just introduced a bunch of barcodes, but in Canada? This is hard to, get money to do
that. You wouldn't need that many, it's not stuff to have millions. If you're just 100, it's good enough.
Well, fair enough, but anyway, I'm just...
Because 100, you don't expect to have millions of clones that survive.
No, but it's going to become pretty standard.
No, I agree. Eventually it will.
I think so.
100, that's good enough to see if there's like some stable polymorphism that can be maintained.
But I think that we can do that even without... I mean, we can clearly do that within the case of antibiotic resistance.
If you do, I mean, to measure 5 phenotypic properties for a whole bunch of, one you pick in the world, that uses a lot of work, right? I mean, so some of these, that may be, labor's cheap in Canada, but the equipment is expensive, and the students are paid for by the government rather than direct, so the sensible systems. But I think one of the things which is, just this back and forth here. I mean, I think, there is a strong tradition in ecology and other things of this is the statistic we should calculate, or this is the thing we should do, instead of saying, let's look at a whole bunch of things without any theoretical framework and kind of ask, right, what is the, how can one look at things that one's already observed?
That usually comes about because, especially in a field ecology, you've got to make some pretty hard choices.
Right.
In order,
you've got whatever it was, 8-dimensional phenotype that you've got. And, there's a lot of different things you can look at that, beyond doing PCA and all the other things.
Yeah, yeah.
And
if you have any suggestions, if you have suggestions, I'd love to hear them.
I'd just like to start with, really simple things about number of identifiable.
But, the metabolic phenotypes, Tom Ferenczi did some work years ago.
He
showed within a chemostat, within 28 days, he had a zoo where every single bacteria had a different phenotype in terms of metabolism. I don't know how stable it was and all this kind of stuff, but your current single glucose in your chemostat was,
it's effectively
very strongly. Very heavy stress. They were dividing very slowly.
That was my recollection was that most of that was effectively neutral. They weren't very long experiments. They were not terribly.
No, it's transient. It may be transient diversity.
But
then the question is, when you get the we already see this in the music grants discussion, previous ones, is that you get this transient diversity initially, but you don't have to go much further. It's when the first mutant's already starting to expand the population, and you start substantially changing the relative fitnesses of things, and the ancestors hang around longer than they should, and so on. So you're getting some of the diversity you're initially getting is already starting to go away, but it looks as if you have subtle changes that are happening, that are changing stuff, and that, in supposedly simple conditions. And so on. Now, yeast is never simple conditions because it goes normally because it goes from fermenting to respiring and has, all these switching stuff going on in it. And so, but that's, that's probably maybe not as much, but certainly is true with some of the bugs. And the pseudomonads, some people claim they eat a mixture of things at the same time, or that they switch from one to another.
They have catabolite repression and stuff like that. And then you can manipulate some of that, or you can, I shouldn't say manipulate, but you can, we can manipulate it.
You don't have to manipulate it. I mean, that's one of the, one of the niches is doing that, you do that slightly differently, right? And it's not, that's can be really hard to pick up in some measurements. but could be important as far as keeping. But it also could be that you, in some ways, which is maybe what you were suggesting when you get this initial diversity and then they seem to go back down again, is in some ways this sort of a bit of specialty and then one of them does better than the other thing as well, and you get a little more generalist and then it's...
Yeah.
Then
you what we found in the Cinemas Fluorescent stuff that builds on Paul Rainey's work was that you get this burst of diversity and then it winnows out, but you still maintain different niche specialists. So you get these biofilm formers and the broth colonizers. But it's the diversity within each category that starts to winnow out. So you still get this coexistence, but, you know.
That's also from polymorphology.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
But we can also show, we've done competitive fitness experiments in those, and again, you know.
Yeah.
But I won't go into it. Anything else? Thanks for doing this.